are listening to IDEA, the podcast about improving data engagement and advocacy. I'm Brianna Wham.
And I'm Shannon Sheridan. In our episodes, we'll be bringing you interviews from real-world data professionals who are engaging their researchers in new and novel ways.
We'll also be reviewing the literature and keeping you up to date on what's getting published that's worth a read, or in your case, a listen.
We hope you'll join us as we talk with our colleagues and see what's working, or what's not, in the wider world of research data management. Welcome, everybody, to today's episode of IDEA. Today, we're going to be looking at a paper titled 10 Simple Rules for Improving Research Data Discovery by Nicole Kontaxis, Jason Clark, Anthony Delarificio, Sarah Gonzalez, Sarah Mannheimer, Peter Oxley, Melissa Radajewski, Alyssa Circus, Amy Yarnell, Michelle Yee, and Christy Holmes. This is a recent paper that was published in PLOS Computational Biology on February 10th, 2022, and you can access the DOI for this article in our show notes. We're going to talk a little bit about this article, why we selected it, and what we found interesting. So I'll start off with the question of why did we select this article? We found this article really interesting because it was written by lots of data librarians and information professionals who are also members of the Data Discovery Collaboration. But instead of being an article that's targeted at other information professionals and data professionals, it's actually targeted at researchers in a research journal that they are more likely to read and therefore come across. And it's unique in that it's giving direct actionable steps to researchers. So as we mentioned, it's published in PLOS Computational Biology, which is an open access publisher that primarily supports research in science and medicine. And the computational biology title in particular features a lot of work that uses computational methods to, as they put it, inform understanding of living systems. And they're specifically mentioning that readers include life and computational scientists. So not a perhaps traditional avenue for information professionals to be publishing in. And so we wanted to highlight it for you all because we thought it might be one that therefore you might not come across fairly easily if you didn't know to look for it.
That's exactly right, Shannon. I think what really kind of gave a really nice overview and highlighted the purpose of this article for me was a quote from it that said, "The promise of data sharing can only be actualized if the right data can be found." And what they're talking about here is that there's this increased adoption of open data practices and data sharing requirements. And as that has become more common, there's going to be an increase in the amount of data that's available, and the places that that data is available is also increasing. And so it's going to be extremely important to examine how the data is being shared and how we're actually going to make it discoverable. And so this article specifically is presenting tools for researchers to make their data more discoverable. And it does this through 10 guiding rules. And these rules take into account actions that are key to success early in the research process, as well as at publication, and touches on how best to use scholarly infrastructure, as well as engage data professionals.
I do love a good checklist. You can just go down and be like, yep, did this, did that. And then you feel a great sense of accomplishment and like you're doing all that you can to get things done.
Me too.
So the 10 rules here that they're encouraging researchers to check off is decide what level of access you can provide to your data, comply with ethical standards, deposit your data somewhere trusted, use persistent identifiers, create thoughtful and rich metadata, choose your keywords carefully, create links to related resources, make supporting information discoverable too, include a data availability statement with your publications and to make sure that it's accurate, and finally, talk to your institutional librarian. Nice shout out there to all of us.
Gotta love when they call out the data librarians.
So we're not going to go through all of these steps individually because a lot of them probably sound very familiar to our data curation professionals who are listening in, but we do want to talk about a couple of interesting things from them and kind of the structure of it. So for each of these points, they are giving you a super concise paragraph of addressing all of these really important things. And they're focusing more on actionable items. So like making a data availability statement, applying keywords, making sure you're getting a DOI, and not theory.
And I think that's something, Shannon, that's really unique about this article is that a lot of things will go into depth about the theory behind it or kind of the background information behind it. But this being tailored for researchers and actually giving them that how-to, I think, is really important.
Right, because how many times do you give a presentation to researchers and say, listen, you need to be doing all of this stuff because it's really, really important. And then they follow up with the question of, okay, sure, but how do I do it? And so this provides a really nice template for, you know, pick two or three of these things. I mean, ideally you would be doing all 10, but
as a start.
It's a start, yeah. And they also, in these steps, are focusing on data sharing in a way that benefits the researcher. So they're saying, we want you to make your data more findable because then more people can use it, more people can cite you. And I think that's a good appeal to the nature of a researcher wanting their work to be made publicly available rather than just a, this is good and you should be doing this. The one thing that gave me pause when I was reading this, though, is the use of the word simple. I know that I personally have tried to avoid that more the more I keep working with data, because I'm realizing that just because it seems simple to you or even to a general research population doesn't mean that something is simple to everyone else. So, you know, if you're working in an institution maybe that doesn't have an institutional repository, maybe it's not so simple to figure out where to deposit your data. Maybe you don't have an institutional librarian that has a specialty in data, and that can make this more difficult as well. Although it kind of parlays well into the article, I think, as a whole, as a study of both simple and complicated, because the way it's structured is that they don't give a ton of information about all the individual points. And Brianna, I'm sure you and I have both given presentations on entire topics that are just one of these bullet points.
Definitely, Shannon.
And so, you know, the idea is, yeah, we can condense them into these 10 easy steps, but all of these can also be long, complicated topics within themselves. So.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. I think it's something where, in the sense, it's concise and it's giving enough information to get started, but these concepts can be complicated.
And I like that word. I think that's what this is, a concise template.
Exactly. I think I had another point that I thought was really interesting in this article and something I was really glad to see is they talk about in rule one, which was decide what level of access you can provide. They talk about the distinction between data discovery and data access. And I, for one, was really excited to actually see a discussion on terminology that's making that clear distinction. I think all too much in this field of kind of data management, with research support coming from all different places, with people with different backgrounds, this terminology can be used in different ways. So having this kind of clear definition, I thought was really beneficial for having shared vocabulary between researchers, data stewards, and infrastructure specialists.
That's true. I mean, I know I run into that a lot when I'm talking about FAIR data, and a little bit of context, I work at one of the national labs, and some of the data there cannot be shared publicly. I used to also be a health science librarian, and there's another scenario where you have a lot of data that can't be shared publicly. And so whenever I would talk to researchers about FAIR data, trying to make that distinction, like just because someone can find your data doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be able to access all of it. And it's really important for that findability, even if there isn't access. And so you're right, having a discussion of vocabulary in a publication for researchers helps keep moving that conversation forward and getting us towards a common language to talk about data.
Exactly. And that's something I think, like you just highlighted perfectly, what they kind of say concisely in their point about this is that data can be discoverable without being openly available. And this is likely to become more important, I even think, in like the researchers I support with the new NIH data management and sharing policy. So as a data librarian at a large institution, I'm going to be supporting researchers that now have data that has these privacy considerations, but have to make it discoverable, not accessible, but discoverable.
And one way of doing that, I really like they mentioned in rule five, is with thoughtful and rich metadata.
That's exactly right. I think these definitely link together. So they talk about this creation of thoughtful and rich metadata. And they nicely outline the levels to which various forms of metadata can be used to make data discoverable or findable, both for humans and machines, and how that then influences discovery and what actions a researcher can take to make their data more discoverable through this thoughtful, rich metadata. And in particular, what I thought was interesting was the discussion on the value of persistent identifiers in this space and talking about how persistent identifiers alone are not the solution. There's that need for that descriptive, rich metadata that's in a structured format, and also the considerations for how to use elements and other kind of areas of metadata, like titles, for instance, to enhance discovery.
One of my biggest things is encouraging more description, just in general, whether that's in metadata or in a README or even in the abstract for or description for the repository where you're putting the data.
I agree completely. I think that I often hear all too much that, oh, the information's in the article. But articles have page limits and such. And so like the actual detailed information that's going to allow you to reuse that data is coming in this documentation that's associated with the data files themselves.
Right. And sometimes they get separated. Sometimes you've got data that doesn't refer to the publication that it was originally published with. And one of the things that they mentioned here is creating links to related resources, which I thought was a great and probably not common thing that researchers think of. But this idea of being intentional on how they're linking to other components of the research ecosystem. So including links for labs or personal websites, linking to social media, a lay summary describing findings for the public. If you're working with a code repository like GitHub, linking there. And linking all of those objects together in this really nice web so that if someone stumbles on one part of that research output, they can find the rest of it. And they also recommend getting the most out of these linkages by using best practices for whatever research object you're dealing with. So like software might have different best practices than what you would do with data or a publication. And again, they're bringing in PIDs to this process as well. I've been thinking and becoming a lot more interested actually in this idea of related resources because our institutional repository does this really well. Researchers can upload and store their data on our infrastructure, but they can also create different entities for things like the researcher can have their own page. They can link to different scientific instruments that data is coming from. And then that particular record has all kinds of information about the instrument specifically. And it creates this really robust record so that if you find data, you can figure out who made it, what machine it came from, what project it was created as a part of. And it creates this much more robust and interesting infrastructure than just a single record would provide.
Yeah. And I think as data professionals, this actually also leads to a really great opportunity for us for training purposes, because I do think, and for kind of some culture change, I do think there's kind of established workflows among researchers for, or starting to be in some fields, for linking to data sets in their articles, but it's not as frequent to have the reverse. So where they're linking back to the actual article from the data set, or as you mentioned, making sure that there are these linkages to equipment used, and which then brings in even more information. And so I think kind of offering training and kind of getting that into the research workflow is going to be vital for this to be successful. But I think there's huge advantages, as you described. And I think related to this, the idea of kind of linking various things and providing information about how the data is associated with the rest of the project and other components of the project and different data types is brought up in another one of their rules of including an accurate data availability statement with your publications. And I know Shannon and I both talked about this. And one of the things that we felt here was that data availability statements don't get enough good press.
I am nodding vigorously. And I just, even good press, I don't think they get enough press, period. But I'm not going to go off on a tangent there.
I agree. I feel like they're not talked about a lot. They're usually done as a component of the publishing process. Like, I have to have my data shared. This journal has a requirement. Let me throw something together.
And all they take, it's two elements. It's, you know, tell me where the data is stored and information to identify the data set within that storage facility. So it's like, hey, the data for this report is in this repository and here's the DOI.
Yeah, I have seen some successful efforts around almost like boilerplate language for data availability statements, but at the same time, making sure that that doesn't lack information then, because projects can be distinct in kind of what they're presenting in that data availability statement.
That's true. And I guess if we're encouraging linking to other things, you know, a data availability statement can also have the potential to link to things like software or maybe even public description or project pages or things like that, that maybe, and I don't know, maybe that's putting too much pressure on the data availability statement to be all things to all people. And I'm sure that it could also be accurately and helpfully described elsewhere.
Maybe that's where some clarity is needed, right? Data is a broad thing. What data and data types are expected to be included in this data availability statement? I fall on the park of if there's something that a researcher trying to reproduce this or reuse that data is going to need, it should be linked in the data availability statement, whether it's code or data sets.
Yeah, and they do take some time to explain some potential hurdles like restricted data, which is really good for this journal genre and audience in particular, but also just good things to keep in mind for any researcher.
Yeah, I agree.
And then finally, last but not least, because I can't think of a good segue for this, Brianna, but it's us. Talk to your institutional librarians. I thought it was great that this article gave a shout out and mentioning what a good resource that institutional librarians or, you know, I know that can sometimes be a narrow term for data professionals that might not be within their title, but for a lot of places, especially here in the US where Brianna and I are both based and where these article authors are mostly based, libraries and librarians tend to be the ones who are supporting researchers in this type of work.
Yeah, and it's nice to see that not only is the acknowledgement here, right? Like these data professionals, institutional librarians are starting to get noticed and represented in things like NIH and NSF's recommendations for conducting good data management and openly sharing your data and complying with those requirements.
Right. And more librarians are having that domain knowledge and that policy knowledge and are able to help apply that. So even if you're someone who data is not your full-time job description, because I know there's a lot of people out there who data is only part of their responsibility, but it's great to see a promotion of strengthening of that recognition of expertise.
And I think another interesting point here, Shannon, it's not actually a point that they brought up in one of their rules, but it's how this article can be used as a tool for engagement. So for us as data professionals, how can we actually use an article like this as a tool for engagement? And how is this article itself a tool for engagement?
Plot twist, this is why we picked the article, because it can be both.
Exactly. So right, this article in and of itself is an example of engaging with researchers directly. So it's, as Shannon mentioned at the top, it's in a computational biology journal. The readers of that journal are primarily going to be researchers. So the authors of this article use this as an engagement or outreach tool for providing best practices on data discovery for researchers.
Yeah, and at the same time, it can also provide fodder for curriculum and engagement ideas for data practitioners, which is why we wanted to share it with you all. Because on one hand, maybe it will prompt an idea of something that you could write about and share in an avenue that would reach researchers directly. Or maybe you can just take one of these top 10 rules for data discoverability and turn it into a workshop or an email or something.
I know I'm already considering taking these top 10 rules and say doing a workshop on data discovery, and having this as kind of the background structure for that curriculum makes that job of turning that into that workshop into reality much easier as a data professional offering that type of engagement opportunity.
Yeah. And I guess this kind of brings us to a question, the end of the episode that we wanted to finish with a question for our listeners in thinking about what other ways could an article like this be retooled for engagement purposes? Because here on the show, that's what we're interested in. How do we engage with researchers in different avenues, different formats, about different topics? So looking at this article as an example, How could it be retooled for engagement purposes? So feel free to shoot us an email, drop a note in the comments on the podcast, on the episode, and let us know how you might be able to take an article like this and retool it for engagement purposes.
Yeah. And as Shannon mentioned, we hope to do this with each episode. And so if you can offer that kind of and have that community engagement of listeners from this podcast able to support each other in creation of these types of engagement opportunities.
Well, Brianna, I think that brings us to the end of the article and the end of the show. Any last thoughts?
I think we covered it all, Shannon.
So we hope you all enjoyed spending some time with us today. Go read the article if what we've spoken about today piqued your interest and you want to learn a little bit more, because we definitely didn't do a deep dive on every point that they covered, and it really is a great read. See y'all next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us, folks. We hope you enjoyed this episode of IDEA.
You can find the resources from today's show in the show notes.
Our theme music is by Scott Holmes. And a big thanks to the Research Data Alliance Interest Group, Engaging Researchers with Data, for supporting our work.
If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to rate or review us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next time.